Warriors Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My mother, Caroline, is not with us today. She actually had to play piano for a funeral today and at her church. And I'm just really actually very proud that at 84 years old, she's still doing that. And I hope I'm still doing this when I'm 84 years old, which doesn't seem as old as it used to. But anyway, we have, as always, a fascinating guest for you here on Writers' Voices. E.R. Ramzapur is a writer based in California. She also works as a content marketer, writing about cybercrime and online fraud. She studied political science at UC Berkeley, where she researched underground literature in resistance movements and discovered the forgotten story of Faux Soir, which I may not have pronounced right either, but her writing has been featured in McSweeney's, and The Ventriloquist is her first novel. She lives with her partner and a terrier mix named Lada. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Evan.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, how do you say Faux Soir?
That's a great question. That's how I've been saying it. You know, during my first reading, I actually had a Belgian woman in the audience who was sure to correct my pronunciations after my reading, which I appreciated, but I retained none of it, unfortunately.
Oh, of course. I know. It's so hard. When you're
it's
not
really
familiar.
Hard.
Yeah.
So, exactly.
So, you know, The Ventriloquist is a World War II novel based on this true story that is really quite unusual. And like you, it says that you researched underground literature and resistance movements. First of all, how did you become interested in that? And how do you go about studying that?
Yeah, so when I was in college, I was very precocious and had planned to go to grad school. So I was taking a graduate class, even though I was an undergrad, my second semester that I was there. And I was trying to come up with an idea for a paper that would impress my professor. And I had always been drawn to political humor. And I thought that I wanted to write something about political humor, but in researching political humor, I struck up a conversation with a friend at the time, who is now my wife, and she mentioned this type of underground literature called Samizdat, which is Russian underground literature that dates around the time of the Cold War. And the reason why we got on that topic is that a lot of Samizdat was funny, a lot of it was satirical, and it was the secret literature that they used to sort of resist the Soviets and poke fun at them. So I started to do more digging into that because I'd never heard of anything like this before, and I was really intrigued. And in doing so, I learned how important underground media is to resistance movements. And in fact, every rebel movement in Europe during World War II used secret newspapers and like secret radio broadcasts to survive and resist the Nazis. And so in kind of combing through documents and briefings that I read online and in archives, that's how I came across the story of Faux Soir, this ragtag group of Belgians who printed tens of thousands of copies of a fake Nazi newspaper. And I was just blown away and had to learn more.
Wow. Why do you think we don't know more about this?
I think there's a couple of reasons why. You know, when I was studying political science, and I think political scientists and the rest of the public at large just don't pay attention to literature as a component in resistance, because it also kind of seems counterintuitive. You know, when you think about like what resistance looked like during World War II, and if you think about the popular portrayals in books and in movies, resistance is very highly militarized. Like there are always men with guns and then, you know, soldiers storming the beaches. And that is the picture of resistance that we have. And that feels very intuitive because, of course, people needed to fight with guns to resist occupation. But one of the things that really struck me and surprised me when I was doing some research for this paper is that resistance didn't only look like that. And in fact, there were so many ordinary people who resisted in these crazy creative ways that just seemed so outlandish and unbelievable, but actually, you know, actually happened. One of which is the story of the ventriloquist, the story of Faux-Soie.
So tell us a little bit more about that story, about what actually happened there.
Yeah, so in October of 1943, this guy named Marc Aubryon, who was a very minor journalist at a minor resistance newspaper, decided that he wanted to do something big to commemorate the German defeat in World War I, so he could show the people of Belgium, you know, who had been suffering under occupation for a number of years, that the Germans were not infallible, like they could be defeated again. So his idea was to take the most prominent newspaper in the country, Le Soir, which is still the most prominent newspaper in Belgium. It's basically like the New York Times of Belgium, and create a satirical fake copy of that and slip that out onto the streets so the public could read it and laugh. And he planned to get this done right under the Germans' noses. So in this period of just 18 days, under 3 weeks, him and his ragtag band of friends, which included this like young child and this woman who was a judge and this, you know, kind of crazy cast of characters, were able to get 60,000 copies of this newspaper out before the Germans knew what hit them.
Oh. Now, in your book, there's sort of another layer to the story where they have been, this band of people were recruited by the Nazis to supposedly put out anti-American, anti-ally propaganda. Is that something that you added to the story?
That is something that I added, yeah. And it's something that was not uncommon. One of our like villain of the story, who's a man named, a Nazi named August Wolf, he starts off by introducing something called black propaganda, which is propaganda that's designed to look like it's from one side, but it's actually from the other side. And this was something that the Nazis did a lot of, so this very well could have happened.
Wow. Wow. And was Le Soir at that time a collaborist publication?
It was, yeah. It was mostly just printing German propaganda, and a lot of people still read it because it was really the only source of news that they had. So even if it wasn't exactly the truth, or there was this Nazi propaganda slant to it, you know, what else? What were people going to do? They wanted to know if they had family on the front lines or something. Like, they wanted to have some clue as to what their movements might be. But it was, yeah, it was a collaborationist newspaper, and it was very popular. Like, even the artist and cartoonist behind The Adventures of Tintin, he was drawing comics for Le Soir at the time.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, like, yeah, exactly. That's how popular it was.
Wow. And so Le Soir was being published, but there were other underground papers being published at that time. Now, was August Wolf actually the Nazi in charge of trying to squash all these underground publications?
No, he was a fictional character who
okay.
I made up.
Okay.
Yeah. But the ministry that he's in charge of, the Ministry of Perception Management, that was real.
Wow. Wow. Which of the other characters other than Marc Aubryon were actual historical characters?
Yeah, so the narrator of the book for most of the book is a young child named Gammon. And we do know that there was actually a young child who helped Aubryon out. We don't know the details of who they were because they didn't, you know, Aubryon and his friends didn't keep a lot of records about this as they were doing it very quickly. But we do know that person was real. The judge, Andre Grandjean or Grandjean, I apologize for my French, for anyone who's listening. I'm so sorry. Your language, I'm not worthy of it. she was a real person as well. She was a judge who was operating under the Nazi regime, but she was still sympathetic to the Allies. And I think that's just really amazing that, first of all, there was a woman judge during that time. And second of all, that she was kind of able to play both sides, where she could help the Allies, but still stay in power under the Nazis. She's amazing.
Wow.
And also the director of the press department was real. And many of these other, you know, Martin Victor, the sociologist, was real. So most of the characters are real.
Now, what about Spiegelman?
So David Spiegelman, who, you know, is kind of the heart and soul of the novel, I think, was not real. He is someone I made up. He's based on a real person who was a Dutch forger, who was a gay man who worked for the resistance and blew up the Nazi population registry in Amsterdam, which is amazing. But yeah, I completely made him up.
Wow.
He was a lot of fun to write.
Wow. So at what point in your investigation of this did you decide, hey, I should write a novel about this story?
Pretty immediately, yeah. You know, as I was reading about this, it had such a cool, like, Ocean's 11 feel to it, but it was also sort of the capers that I was reading about that, you know, it's really funny. In order to get this done, so many things had to go right, but so many of those things went wrong, but they got it done anyway. And it felt very Charlie Chaplin-esque to read about their capers. And I really wanted to, like, read this book or see this movie. So I just wrote it myself.
Had you done any creative writing of the sort before this book?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've been writing ever since I was a little kid. Like, my earliest memories, even before I could read, just start pretending to write, like getting my dad's newspapers and getting a piece of paper and trying to copy the words.
Wow.
So I've always written.
Had you written any novels before? I know this is the first one published, but is this the first one you've written?
Oh, no. I've been trying. You know, there are a lot. It takes a lot of failures until you find the right fit, you know, and I was kind of a precocious kid and started writing novels when I was like 14 and wanting to get them published. And it was, you know, it was really a good experience because I was working seriously towards publication for about 12 years. That means I just started a little bit earlier than most people do.
Well, I think it seems quite obvious to me reading this that it isn't a novice attempt at writing a novel.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
You've got so much going on in here, and of course, you have a compelling plot, which you didn't have to create. You know, you found the plot, but all of the characters and the ins and outs and the structure of the novel are very sophisticated, and
really hold your
attention. Yeah. Yeah, and we're talking about The Ventriloquists by E.R. Ramsapour, and it's a novel about the Belgian resistance, which, it's interesting, I had another book recently that had a character from the Belgian resistance, and it's escaping my attention, my memory at the moment. Hopefully I'll remember in a little bit, but the title of the book. But we don't know that much. At least I didn't know that much about Belgium's involvement in World War II and how really horribly they suffered from the Germans.
Yeah, I didn't know a lot about it either. And it was just, it was amazing to learn about the occupation of Belgium. And it was also just amazing to learn about all of the little ways in which life was able to continue even as people were suffering. Like the artist Magritte was in Belgium during the occupation, and he, one of the things that he did was that he kept painting, but he didn't have canvas, obviously, to paint on, but he painted on empty beer bottles. So people found a way to still be creative and to survive even as they were suffering.
Wow, there were like wholesale slaughters of communities in Belgium.
Exactly, it's really
invaders.
Horrifying.
Yeah. It's just unbelievable, really. And so historical, you know, I love a good historical novel. This is kind of interesting in that although you have the broad brushstrokes of what happened, you had to fill in a lot of details. How did you go about finding the information, finding what you needed to know to do that?
Yeah, like you said, there wasn't a lot out there, especially since this story unfolded in less than 3 weeks, and it happened in secret. So we don't know a lot about the events that unfolded or the people who carried them out. So I pieced together what I could. Other than that, I mostly just needed to read about the Belgian resistance, and I couldn't find a lot of information about this specific incident. But the thing that was actually more challenging even than imagining how this might have come about was presenting some of these really outlandish schemes in a way that didn't feel too cartoonish. So to kind of give you an example, there's a point in the middle of the book where the characters need to create a distraction. And so to do that, they decide to persuade the Royal Air Force of England to bomb Belgium. And to just bomb Belgium a little bit, not bomb it too much. And that was something that actually happened. These people really did that, ordinary people. And I had to figure out, like, how am I going to put this on the page in a way that isn't just going to make the reader close the book and say, there's no way that this happened. And I got a lot of pushback from publishers who were like, there's no way people will believe this. But it's true. It happened.
Wow. It is really inspiring how brave people were in the ways that they resisted. And
it really is.
Yeah. Now, why did they feel the need to make this, the Fossoir publication, happen in 18 days? Was there a reason behind that?
They wanted to get it out in time for Armistice Day. And just Aubryon thought of the idea towards the end of October. So that didn't leave them that much time before Armistice Day.
Well, And did the publication have the impact that they wanted it, that they had hoped it would have?
I really believe it did. You know, they were able to get tens of thousands of copies out. People did pick up the copies. A good number of them have survived. I actually own 5 of them now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I go on eBay like once a month and see if I can find them, and I usually can. So people kept them. They held on to them.
Oh, that's fascinating. So what are some of the things that were in it? Some of the columns, some of the reports, some of the photos?
Yeah, you can actually, if you want to look it up, you can find pictures of it online. And if anyone reads French, you can read the text. It's very funny. I've had it translated. But some of the text was, so there was this recurring column in which the Nazis would report on their movements. And they wanted to make their movement sound really impressive, like what the German army was doing. That was the name of the column. And they usually had these names for their military formations that were very sort of puffed up and like obnoxious. So the Aubryon, what he did was he made fun of those names, where he would say things like, the German army advanced in their hedgehog position, just like completely making it sound ridiculous. So there was stuff like that. There were fake obituaries, which just blows my mind to think of the audacity of these people who were putting their lives on the line for a joke, and they wrote fake obituaries for Nazi sympathizers. Oh, it's just amazing. I recommend reading it if anyone gets a chance, reading the newspaper.
Are there any English translations of it available?
There aren't. But I put some of it through Google Translate, and like I said, I had a friend help out with some of it.
Okay.
But there are translations in the novel.
Right.
Of specific sections.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the characters in the novel. We've talked about a few of them, but you gave each of the main characters a name, a nickname. And tell me a little bit about why you did that and how that works and what those names mean.
Yeah, that's a good question. So each the book is kind of broken up into these rotating points of view where we have scenes that are told from the perspective of one character and then another and then another. And at the beginning of the book, to kind of help orient the reader, I have a list of the characters plus their nicknames.
Like, which I found, I found that very helpful, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad. So part of it was for that reason, because I know that it can be a challenge to keep track of a number of characters. And I've heard a lot of good feedback from people who said it actually wasn't a challenge because they could have these nicknames to remember. So part of it was that. I feel like it adds this fun layer, this fun structure to the book. And there are kind of, I want to say kind of Easter eggs that I planted related to each character's name. And to give you an example, Marc Aubryon is the jester, which on the surface, you know, that makes sense. Like, he's the one who thought of this really funny idea. But there's another layer of meaning to this, because in medieval courts, the jester was the only person in the court who was allowed to really tell the truth to the king. He was the only one who could be honest. So there are sort of these layers of meaning for all the names. And I think that's fun for readers to discover that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so go down the list of the characters for us.
All right, let me open my book here. So we have the jester, Marc Aubryon, the smuggler, Lotta Tarkovich, who, if you remember, my dog is named Lotta. She's named after that Lotta.
Wait, which one's named after which?
The dog is named after the character.
Okay.
they share a lot of characteristics. My dog likes to smuggle her toys into, you know, places where they don't belong. Then we have the gastromancer, David Spiegelman, the saboteur, Theo Moliere, the professor, Martin Victor, the pyromaniac, Gammon, the Dybbuk, August Wolf, and the scrivener, Eliza.
And what is a gastromancer?
So that's a great question. I'm actually going to read a section from the book, a chapter called The Gastromancer's Tale, a little bit later, that goes into some detail about that. But it's sort of a mythological term for someone who can throw their voice, or a ventriloquist.
Okay. And what is a dybbuk?
So in, I believe, Jewish folklore, a dybbuk was this spirit who wanders the earth because he has a task that is unfinished. And so he's looking for some mortal person to help him finish the task so his soul can finally rest.
And why did you make the villain that the Dybbuk? What's the reasoning behind that?
Yeah, without giving too much away, you know, David Spiegelman, who is our gastromancer, our literary ventriloquist, who can throw his voice and write in the style of anyone from, you know, his own mother to Winston Churchill, he's pressed into service for Wolf, the Dybbuk, and the other Nazis. And Wolf and Spiegelman kind of have this interesting relationship that is obviously very strained, but it is symbiotic in a certain way, where Wolf relies on Spiegelman and sort of feeds off of him because Spiegelman can produce a sort of beauty that Nazis cannot, that August Wolf cannot. And Spiegelman is relying on Wolf for safety, for immunity. So they have to kind of, in a sort of weird, perverse way, help each other complete tasks so that their souls can rest. And that, you know, goes back into the mythology of the Dybbuk.
Mm. Now, the book is structured, like you said, rotating points of view, but a very kind of strong chronology. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And counting down, essentially, to the publication date.
Right.
Was this something that you just knew from the beginning that you would structure it that way, or was that something that came about in the process of writing?
Oh, that's definitely something I thought of early on, because I wanted to drive home to the reader the sense of urgency and almost desperation as we get closer and closer to the day that the newspaper was supposed to come out, everyone, our heroes are scrambling to get it done. And I love the idea of starting each chapter with a countdown so that you really feel that tension as you're reading.
Well, why don't you read a little bit from The Ventriloquist for us?
Oh, I'd love to.
Great. And while you're getting that, getting ready to do that, I want to remind our listeners that this is Writer's Voices and that our guest today is E.R. Ramsapour, author of The Ventriloquists.
All right. This chapter is called The Gastromancer's Tale. David Spiegelman's grandmother was an accomplished woman. She had been a skier, a rower, a naturalist, back when being a naturalist still meant discovering things that were not yet discovered, a published writer, and a mother six times over. Then, at the age of 82, she decided it was time she settled down and contemplate her life while she still had some left. Her son and daughter-in-law, Lieb and Ruth Spiegelman, had a modest home in the city. And Spiegelman's grandmother liked how everyone in the neighborhood always kept their windows clean, so she moved into an apartment nearby. It was there David Spiegelman used to visit her at the age of 8 or 9, when his hands were still curious enough to touch things that didn't belong to him. He used to wander through his grandmother's study, running his fingers across the covers of her books when he thought she wasn't looking. "Keep your hands to yourself, David, if you care a thing for your grandmother's heart," she'd tell him, which meant that Spiegelman learned patience as a small boy, waiting until his grandmother was out of the house to begin exploring her books. On one such day, Spiegelman pushed a chair next to his grandmother's shelves and stepped up, holding onto the shelf for balance. Careful to listen for his grandmother's footsteps, young Spiegelman studied the titles on the top shelf. It was then he caught sight of a fat leather-bound volume, unremarkable except for its blank spine. Spiegelman sat cross-legged, turning the book over in his hand. It had not aged well, the spine creaking and the cover spotted with grease. Faint letters spelled out amazing stories of far-off lands. He cracked open the book. The book taught Spiegelman many things his grandmother and parents did not want him to know, about opium and morphine, about people who ate pork and enjoyed it, what women looked like naked, what men looked like naked with other men, about cults, secret societies, children who ignored their parents' advice and became artists or religious figures instead of lawyers or clerks. He took it in, all of it, but it blew over him like a wind, making a strong impression that was nonetheless forgotten quickly. That was until he saw the photograph in the back of the book, the image of the man with his puppet. In the photograph, a man with slicked black hair in a suit sits with a puppet propped on his knee. The man has his hand on the puppet's back. When Spiegelman recalled the photo in his later years, it was difficult for him to remember what he saw in it. He had to imagine himself 8 years old again, untouched by tragedy or responsibility, before the photograph's meaning revealed itself once more. The playful mystery in the man's eyes, the way he leaned into the shadows that touched his face and hands. Of course, Spiegelman, a tiny Jewish boy with asthma and scrawny hands, would want to be that man, that magician. For weeks after, Spiegelman practiced ventriloquy with his brother's wooden puppet. He would sneak out of the house whenever he could. He found himself a little girlfriend, maybe, his parents laughed. Or he would slip into his parents' basement when he could not. Then, when he was ready to show himself for what he was, Spiegelman called his parents and grandmother to a conference. "What I'm about to do has a long and interesting history," Spiegelman sat in front of his parents and grandmother with his brother's puppet on his knee. His brother squirmed in his mother's lap. "Let us start with the name itself. The word ventriloquy is Latin." "Have you been teaching him Latin?" his father whispered to his mother. "No, have you? Not that I can remember." Spiegelman went on. "It means to speak from the stomach. The ancient Romans," he faltered. "No, the ancient Greeks. They did this in their religion. They were called oracles. They would throw their voice and make it sound as though they were talking out of their stomach. And then these oracles would try to interpret the sounds, like the sounds were coming from the gods. It was supposed to help them tell the future or figure out what their ancestors wanted them to do to solve a problem. The Greeks called it gastromancy." Adjusting his sweaty grip on the puppet's back, Spiegelman said, "Hello, I am the puppet. Nice to meet you. Today I'm going to. We can see your lips moving, said Spiegelman's brother. He spoke with exaggerated authority, like a barrister exposing a lie on the witness stand. He was six. And that was the end of David Spiegelman's career as a ventriloquist. Though he never again tried to speak through the mouth of a puppet, Spiegelman continued reading about ventriloquy under the pretense of studying history. Relieved that their son had decided to become a scholar rather than a magician, or, heaven forbid, an artist, his parents encouraged him, buying him books and sending him to study under the most famous historians in the city. But gastromancy pursued him, haunting him like a disease. It followed him even as he slept. He dreamed in strange sounds that he struggled to interpret upon waking. A few years after the puppet show, Spiegelman and his friends were playing in a park an hour before school. The school had a bell, an old cowbell that teachers rang when it was time for the students to go inside. Somehow, Spiegelman and his friends did not hear it. They kept playing until an older boy realized they were an hour late for class. After some debate about the relative merits of blinking in tardy or avoiding school altogether, his friends slipped inside, braced for chastisement. Spiegelman, however, stayed behind. He took some paper and a pen from his book bag, settling under a tree. Without giving much thought to what he was doing, he licked the tip of his pen and wrote, "Mr. Tompkinson, please forgive David's tardiness. My youngest son spent the better part of this morning ill. With his father gone to shop, David had no choice but to stay behind and help me tend to his brother. I shall, of course, ensure he completes his schoolwork. With respect, Ruth Spiegelman." He set back to regard his work. Though it was David Spiegelman who put pen to paper, it was as if his mother had spilled the ink. The handwriting, the curious bend to the letters, she was born left-handed, but her parents forced her to write with her right, as was the custom. It was his mother's voice, the polite but firm phrasing. It was his mother's voice. Even the way the words were positioned on the page, the paragraph starting halfway down the paper and meandering slightly to the left, it was exactly how his mother would have done it. Breathless with his work, Spiegelman went inside the schoolhouse. "David, you're tardy." Mr. Tompkinson gave a pointed glance at the clock, his eyebrows coming together in advance of a lecture. Spiegelman presented the letter to his teacher. As Mr. Tompkinson read it, the boy held his breath. Oh, I see. Oh, dear. Is your brother any better?" David Spiegelman's friends muttered. Praying for them to shut up, the boy managed, "He's fine, thank you." "Good. Give my regards to your mother." Spiegelman's identity changed that day. He was no longer that forgettable boy who read strange books. Now he was a con artist, a master of deceit. Everyone had a physician's note that needed to be written, a parent's signature that needed to be forged, a letter that said they'd been to class or church, or that they hadn't been to Brussels with that girl. His classmates brought him samples, and under the watchful eye of his grandmother's bookshelves, David Spiegelman's pen became them all. This went on for about 3 years, an eternity for a boy Spiegelman's age. The inevitable happened a few months into Spiegelman's 15th year. A girl in another grade, someone he didn't know very well, asked him to write a letter from a teacher to her parents, informing them that she was making satisfactory progress in her courses. There were two problems with this plan. First, the girl was failing. And second, the teacher no longer worked there. 2 days after the girl paid for her letter, Mr. Tompkinson asked David Spiegelman to speak with him after school. Mr. Tompkinson held up a slip of paper covered in even, straight words. Spiegelman's mouth went dry. "How many of these are there?" asked Mr. Tompkinson. "Just the one, sir," said Spiegelman. "You know what I mean. How long has this been going on? How many letters like these have you written? For how many students? Is it only teachers? Are you pretending to be their mothers and fathers as well? Businessmen? Shopkeepers?" Mr. Tompkinson crouched so that his face was level with young David's. The yellow light overhead reflected off his pallid skin. "You could be in a great deal of trouble for this." "I know, sir. I'm sorry. I didn't know. Legal trouble, even." Spiegelman clamped his mouth shut. His parents had taught him from a very young age to revere lawyers almost as prophets. "Sit down." As Spiegelman sat at a desk, Mr. Tomkinson fetched a sheet of paper and a pen. He laid them in front of the boy. I want you to write a letter to me from my wife saying she's leaving me. Say she's having the divorce papers drawn up. Here's my wife's handwriting. Mr. Tomkinson placed two scraps of paper, a grocery list, and a note with instructions to a milkman on the desk. The simple intimacy of the grocery list, eggs, flour, pickles, made Spiegelman ill. I mean to give it to the other woman so that she will come back to me. Spiegelman licked his dry lips. Is your wife leaving you? Why does it matter? It matters if it's not the truth. You lied for them. Mr. Tomkinson pointed out the window at Spiegelman's friends playing in the yard. And you didn't care, did you? It had been fun writing letters for the other children, becoming someone's uncle or teacher or minister. No one had gotten hurt. No one was sad or angry. But adults were different. Adults did not lie in Spiegelman's experience unless they wanted to cause pain. I don't want to do this. Spiegelman pushed the pen and paper away from him. I don't like it. Mr. Tomkinson picked up the paper and slapped it back down. I don't care what you like. The boy stared at the instruments of his trade, the tools of the gastromancer that had brought him so much pleasure. His eyes grew warm with tears. I'm not going to do it. Spiegelman pushed back his chair and stood up. Mr. Tomkinson caught his arm, squeezing until the boy cried out. Write that letter, he said, or everyone will know how you look at that lad, Douglas Vanderwall. What? Whispered David. I've seen it. You're an odd one, David, and you thought no one knew. You thought it was a secret that you kissed that boy Thomas last year in the park. But I know David, and everyone else will know too, unless you sit down in that chair and write that letter. His whole body numb, Spiegelman lowered himself into the chair and picked up his pen. Good boy, said Mr. Tomkinson, as Spiegelman began to write. So commenced Spiegelman's 5 years of servitude. Tomkinson passed the boy's gift and his secret on to another man, who passed him to a friend, and Spiegelman threw his voice into the mouths of adulterers and thieves. It might have gone on forever if the war hadn't broken out. David Spiegelman's grandmother died the day Hitler invaded Poland. Her father was from Poland, and her heart couldn't stand the news of what had happened there. After his brother Abraham disappeared, Spiegelman tried to arrange for his parents to flee Europe, but he couldn't get the visas in time. They died next. Shortly thereafter, the Nazis came for David Spiegelman. The Gestapo found Spiegelman sitting on a chair near his grandmother's bookshelves, the same chair he'd used to climb up and reach amazing stories of far-off lands. He'd been running, sleeping behind old buildings. He'd dug his parents' grave. But Spiegelman was finished living with fear in his chest and dirt in his hair. So he went home to his grandmother's books to join his family in more welcome lands. As the Gestapo leveled their guns at him, Spiegelman clutched a tattered copy of 1001 Nights, trying not to tremble. But they did not fire. Instead, a man with tired eyes held out his hand to Spiegelman. David Spiegelman? I am Brigade Führer August Wolf. Spiegelman shook his hand. It felt stiff but hollow, like the cheap wood the toy maker had used to make his boyhood puppet. Would you come with us, please? Said Wolf. Spiegelman stood on unsteady legs. Where are we going? To the capital. What for? I have a letter for you to write. I'm told you are quite proficient at such things. And that was the beginning of David Spiegelman's career as a ventriloquist.
And that was E.R. Ramzapour reading from The Ventriloquists. You know, one of the things I really appreciate about your writing, Evan, is how frequently you tie things back to other things, other parts of the story, just like the description about Spiegelman shaking Wolf's hand, tying back to his brother's puppet at the beginning of the chapter.
Is this something that just
comes naturally to you, or do you really put a lot of thought looking for that type of a way to tie things together?
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, I think the thing that I try to do is when I'm going about my daily life, I try to pay close attention to how I'm feeling, how even really tense situations make me feel, what they make me think of. And I think people, just you and me and everyone else, I think we draw these associations ourselves all the time. So I think it's just a matter of letting yourself, as a writer, be attuned to those associations when they happen and making note of them and then writing them down.
And do you keep a journal or keep notes of that sort?
I do, yeah. I have this amazing wallet that I found that actually has a little notebook, a little pouch for a notebook in it. So I always have a notebook with me.
Do you write by hand or do you write on computer?
It's a little bit of both. I write a lot on the computer just because I can type a lot faster than I can write longhand. But whenever I really need to sit and work out a scene or outline a part of the book, that's when I need to close my computer and I pull out a notebook and I start working on paper. And I always prefer to write on unlined paper because I don't like having lines that restrict where my thoughts can go. I know I sound like a very pretentious writer saying that, but it's important to kind of have that, I think, creative freedom to be able to play around with a blank sheet of paper.
Wow. I used to do a lot of writing by hand, and in the end, it would be so messy because I'd have arrows and cross things out and up here and down there. But it's, and then going from there into the computer can be a little tricky, typing it up because, like, you have to follow, try
exactly.
And follow your thought process all over again.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I have terrible handwriting too, so that doesn't help.
Oh, me too. Me too. Especially when I'm writing quickly. I mean, I'm capable of having nice handwriting.
Yeah, exactly. Same. But it's an effort.
Yes. Yeah. And it slows things down so much.
Right.
There is a lot of people who think that the connection between the brain and the pen in hand is different than connection between the brain and a keyboard, and mm-hmm. so that you get a different result from doing it that way.
Yeah, and I know a lot of like professors who don't let students have laptops in class, partially so they can't be on Twitter and Facebook and whatever, but partially because it really does help to write things out. I feel that I retain information better when I write it by hand.
I think so too. Yeah. More, I guess there's just more synapses being used in the process.
Right. Yeah, probably.
Right. Now you mentioned outlining. So did you outline this whole book before you started?
Yes, I did. The way I usually like to work is that when I have an idea for a book, I can't sit and try to outline it because it's too overwhelming, to think about the whole project at that point. So I'll usually just sit down and start writing the first chapter and just seeing where it goes and feeling out the voices of the characters and the narration. And once I've had a couple of chapters under my belt and I kind of have an idea of where the story is going and who the characters are, that's when I'll turn to the notebook and start outlining it. In the case of the ventriloquist, it was really important to outline because I had so many things that needed to get done. And like just like the actual ventriloquist, I had so much that needed to get done in such a limited amount of space. I had to be very rigorous.
Did you know which things happened at which point from your research, or did you sort of have to figure all that out?
Yeah, in some cases I did know, in other cases I didn't. Like the thing that I mentioned earlier where our heroes create a distraction by persuading the Royal Air Force to bomb the country, I knew that that happened towards the end, but I didn't know exactly where.
Mm.
So often I kind of knew like towards the beginning of the caper this happened or towards the middle, but the actual timeline I had to sit down and map out what that probably looked like.
Now, these people knew that they were risking their lives to do this. Why do you think they thought this was important enough to risk their life for? Not resisting in overall, but this particular task of creating this fake paper.
Yeah, that's something I thought a lot about when I was building these characters, because I had to really put myself inside the head of people who would die for a joke. But at the end of the day, it wasn't that difficult for me because I understood their desire to use words as weapons. I understood their desire to move people. I don't want to in any way compare, you know, me writing the ventriloquist with the actual printing of this paper. I wasn't, you know, under threat of capture and execution. But this desire to sacrifice and to, just the great personal sacrifice that it takes to move people, that resonates with me as someone who wants to write for a living. So that combined with these great stakes where I'm sure, you know, this was in 1943, so this was a few years into the occupation, and people would have seen their friends killed, their family imprisoned. They would have seen their whole way of life disrupted, their art and their books, their music taken away from them. I can really understand the desire to show the people that the Nazis are not invincible. They may have occupied our country, but they can't take our spirit.
It kind of reminds me of the in The Sound of Music where they're singing Edelweiss as a,
yeah
which, you know,
yeah, I had that thought too.
Yeah, did you? Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like, why risk getting, you know, getting killed really for a song? But it's way more than that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was looking up quotes. My mother usually does a quote at the end, but since she's not here today, I looked up, was trying to find one relevant. And one of the ones, it's not the one I chose to use at the end, but it fits really well, was, "I believe in the magic and authority of words." And that was from Renee Char. I don't know who that is, but and that was under quotes about resistance. So
yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, literature and writing has really plays such an important part. When you think back about the Revolutionary War and the, you know, "Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death," and, you know, Patrick Henry, mm-hmm. and some of the other, like the pamphlets that were being written, and of course Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. Would we have had a Revolutionary War without that? Without the Declaration of Independence? I don't know.
Probably not.
Probably not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, the old saying, the pen is mightier than the sword.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I really do believe that.
How long did you work on the ventriloquists?
That's always a tough question to answer. I feel like I'm still working on the ventriloquists. There's a part of me that will always be working on the ventriloquists. You know, the actual writing took about a year, but the editing and the trying to get it published and then doing more editing once it had been sold, the whole process probably took about 3 years, I think. And the writing was actually not the hard part. It was the editing that was way more difficult, because there are a lot of moving parts in this book, and a publisher understandably is very cautious about what the market is willing to read and how much work they're willing to do. So this sort of back and forth push and pull between making sure the book was marketable and readable, but also being true to the history and juggling all these moving parts was very challenging.
Were there some things that you had to cut out because of that you wish you had been able to leave in?
There was a lot that I had to cut out, actually, which is, it's probably for the best because there's a lot going on in this book. None of the real events, all of the true events that I knew about made it into the book. But there were a lot of little details about the occupation that I felt were important, or details about the characters' lives that I felt were important, that didn't necessarily make it in. But that's okay. I still feel like the book is an accurate representation of what happened, and it's true to the spirit of the newspaper and of these characters.
Now, you mentioned that you went to write for a living. You studied political science. That's not usually what people who are setting out to be writers study. What was going on there?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to, most people don't start out writing for a living immediately. Like, I still have a day job. So I studied political science originally with the intention of becoming a lawyer. And then I interned at a law firm for a semester. And no, it was not for me. I feel like practicing law is one of the things where it is either very much for you or very much not. And I was part of that second camp.
Mm.
So I abandoned that plan. And then I was going to go to grad school to get a PhD in political science. But I decided to write novels instead.
That sounds like a lot more fun.
It does, doesn't it?
But also not an easy, it's not an easy path. For most people. Now, you know, it sounds like you are still fairly young because you said something about age 14 being 12 years ago. So I'm, you know, just guessing. But
yes,
but
that's correct.
So, and you have your first novel published already. And what was your path to publication like? Was it like you got an agent right away, they sold the book right away, or was it a little, and because we do have authors that happens to. Others, sometimes it takes 30 or 40 tries. Most people somewhere in the middle. So where are you?
Yeah, I'm somewhere in the middle. I think it's not an easy road for anybody, even when your book does sell immediately. I think one of the most rewarding parts of this process is making all of these other author friends, and they're all, you know, everyone has anxiety about the process. It's hard not to. But I did get my agent fairly quickly. I sent out, you know, the way it works is you have to send out these emails to agents letting them know what your work is about, and situating it in the market in just a few paragraphs. And any writer will tell you that that is way harder than writing a book. It's distilling all of these hours of labor and sweat and tears into two paragraphs. Not easy. So I got an agent who I absolutely adore pretty quickly. But then the path to publication was not necessarily smooth. We had a lot of interest from publishers, but they seemed to feel one of two ways. People were either really excited because this is not the typical World War II book at all. This is very different. And that either scares people or excites them. So we had to find one who was not scared off by how new and different and out there it is. And then, you know, like I said, there was a long editing process before the book was ready for publication.
And it's a fairly long book also. It's like how many pages? 500 and some pages.
It's not short.
And it's fairly complex. But it is, it's not hard to read. It's not dense. It moves quickly.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. It moves very quickly. It holds your attention. It does take a little while to kind of figure out the characters in, you know, who's who and what the distinctions are between them. Some of them are, Gamine is easy. And actually
right.
My favorite character, I think.
Great.
Yeah.
That makes me really happy. I love him.
And Mark, the jester, is also, well, actually, most of them are pretty distinctive. There's just a few that are maybe less, that we're seeing from their point of view less frequently. And so.
Right.
Yeah. So that makes a difference. Do you have any advice that you would give to other would-be historical novelists?
I think my advice to anyone who wants to write a novel, I guess I can address like anyone who wants to write a novel and specifically historical fiction. For specifically historical fiction, I would say don't get too bogged down in details and think instead about the feelings and the, you know, the larger takeaways that you want your reader to get from this book. I've had some people who have like minor historical quibbles with things that happen in this book. And that's not the point. I'm not a historian. The point is, look at this extraordinary thing that people can do. Look what any of us can do if we are so inspired. And to writers more broadly or aspiring writers, I would say, you know, it's going to take a lot of work, probably a lot more work than you even know. and a lot of luck, but you work to create your own luck, and the luck will find you if you keep at it.
Oh, I like that. Work to create your own luck, and the luck will find you. Is that kind of what you live by?
It is, yeah, because so much of this process is just so random. It's so unpredictable. It's just sheer luck. So I just, the only thing I can control is the work that I put in. And then I have to create opportunities for the luck to find me.
Now, I know that with this book, it came out in August, I believe.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And what kind of response have you received from it?
A very positive response so far. Yeah, all of the critical reviews were really great. And I've just been getting so many wonderful emails from readers who love the book and love the characters and who have family who served in the Belgian Resistance and who are so excited that the story is getting told.
Oh, that's wonderful. And have you done
it
many
really
readings?
Is.
You did mention that one of your first ones that there was someone correcting your pronunciation. But, have you done a lot of readings?
I have, yeah. I just actually finished my book tour last week, and I did a lot of events around the Bay Area, which is where I'm from, and also an event in Seattle. I'll be doing another event in Seattle in December at this Writers Institute called Hugo House. I'll be doing a panel called The Path to Publication. But other than that, I'm mostly done with events for the time being.
So does that mean you're on to your next book?
I'm on to my next book.
And how far into it are you?
I'm about 4 chapters into the next book, and it's completely outlined.
I was going to say, so that means, based on what you told me before, that you've got your outline. And again, is it historical fiction again?
No, it's not actually.
Ah.
It's speculative fiction.
Oh, wow!
Yeah, that's... I actually think speculative fiction is where I'm really meant to be, and I'm, you know, the ventriloquist was a one-off, I think. I really was inspired by this one story and wanted to get it out there. But other than that, I love speculative fiction and magical realism.
Who are some of your favorite writers in that genre?
In speculative fiction, you know, the next book that I'm working on, and this is going to be, everybody knows and loves The Handmaid's Tale, but the next book that I'm working on really kind of draws on my love for The Handmaid's Tale. It's basically what I will say about it, I don't want to say too much, is that it's as though The Handmaid's Tale were about language.
Aha. Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Little teaser.
yeah. You know, there was a quote that I found from Margaret Atwood on resistance, too. I believe
Oh, really?
In the resistance, as I believe there can be no light without shadow, or rather no shadow unless there is also light, which came from The Handmaid's Tale.
I just adore that.
Isn't that great? And
yeah.
We're out of time. And I really thank you so much for being with us, Evan.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
Yeah. And the book, if in case you don't remember, The Ventriloquist, the author E.R. Ramzapur. And the closing quote that I did choose for this, which I think is really fitting, do not think that one has to be sad in order to be militant, even though the thing one is fighting is abominable.
Oh, I love that.
And that is from Mikhail Foucault, which I'm probably mispronouncing, from Anti-Oedipus, Capitalism, and Schizophrenia.
Oh, wow. That's a mouthful.
it is, isn't it? So thank you again for spending this hour with us, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.